Les colloques du Collège de France.
And I'm happy to start with the first speaker of the afternoon. Let me introduce Jean-Rémy King, who is a researcher at CNRS and currently on detachment at Meta AI, where he leads the brain and AI team within the fundamental AI research division, FAIR, which used to be called Facebook AI Research, I guess, but now it's Meta. Jean-Rémy is also an ex-member of the lab. He did fantastic work, I have to say. I could speak for hours about what Jean-Rémy managed to accomplish during his stay in the lab, but he moved on, and now he's making major advances in understanding the neural code of language, which is the topic of today's talk. Help me to welcome Jean-Rémy.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you, and thanks for organizing this really delightful workshop. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see so many well-known faces. Before I start, I put too many slides, so I wanted to ensure that I was spending at least 1 minute on the most important one. The work I'll be presenting today is the result of a team that I have the chance to work with at Meta, but also in tight collaborations with academic partners here in Paris, but also in Spain, in the Netherlands, and in England, and without whom this work would not be possible. So I'm infinitely grateful to all of them. All right, so our species is obviously unique in its ability to master language. We can learn to understand and produce sentences we've never heard before in a way which is radically different from any other communication abilities in the animal kingdom. It is presumably because of language that we can acquire knowledge across individuals and therefore bypass the slow evolution of natural selection, and presumably because of language that we built civilization and technology and really made us such an invasive species, to take the words of Jean-Jacques Hublin. However, how language is come up from the brain remains remarkably unclear. We start to have a clear idea of what neural networks in the brain are directly relevant for language, but the exact computations or the representations of language have long been difficult to identify, let alone how these representations come about during development. And these are two historical questions that I'll try to tackle through a new type of tool, which are LLMs, large language models, which, as you all know, are remarkable AI algorithms that apparently can process language in a meaningful fashion. All right, so the structure of language is remarkably regular. Scholars over the centuries have identified that human languages tend to follow a very particular topology, which is the tree structure. Here is an example from Samuel Clarke in the 19th century, where he used this illustration to show the tree structure of sentences. So, for instance, the king of shadow loves a shining mark. Oh, God never meant that man should scale the heaven by stride of human wisdom. You can, for those of you who have done linguistic, sort of see the premises of a dependency structure, which is depicted over here. And over the years, this formalism has been improved. And the reason why we think that this is necessary, that this tree structure is necessary, is because the position of the word in a sentence in itself is not sufficient to understand a sentence. You need to build this latent tree structure. So, for instance, if you hear this sentence, "A man on the moon smiled," you instantly understand that it is the man that smiles and not the moon, although the moon is indeed closer to that verb. And this is not due to semantics or to pragmatics. You could replace this with pseudo words and you would still understand that Tufa here is a subject of smile. So somehow, when you hear a sentence, your brain needs to link, to bind those words in a particular fashion to understand what is the underlying meaning. And while this formalism has been extremely fruitful in linguistics, how this relates to neural activity is one of the big conundrums in the field. And that's because symbols and tree structures are not really the type of formalism that easily adapts to, let's say, the vectorial patterns of neural activity. And this is where LLMs and AI systems come in handy, right? Because these are connectionist or vectorial models that also have quote-unquote neurons in their, that allows them to represent information. And so we could perhaps look into how they represent language to serve as a hypothesis generator and understand perhaps how the brain functions. All right. So the key idea, which was already touched upon by several speakers, and in particular Doris earlier this morning, is this idea of representational spaces. In both the biological neurons and in artificial neurons, the primary operation that they do is a weighted sum, right? They have an input onto their dendrites, and this input can be weighted by the strengths of the synapses. And so you can think of this input as a coordinate in a high-dimensional space. And this is true for biological neurons, and this is true for artificial neurons. What people have observed over the years, and in particular in the case of language, is that deep learning algorithms shape these representational spaces in a very particular fashion. So for instance, if you take a word embedding, which is a relatively basic algorithm that tries to transform words into these vectorial patterns, you can observe that they use specific direction to represent specific features. So for instance, the representations of a man would be over here in this coordinate space, king would be over here, queen over here, and woman over here. And so the relative direction between man and woman is collinear to the relative direction between king and queen. So you can see that this word embedding has somehow used one of these directions as a semantic property. And this is true for the male-female feature, but this is also true for verb tense, even though there are some here irregularities or exceptions in this particular grammar. And this is also true for world knowledge, for instance, the country-capital relationship in these word embeddings. So we can see that these representational spaces that are built by language models starts to capture semantic features. Now, one of the key issues is how you combine those features in the first place. It's one thing to embed a feature in a high-dimensional space. It's another problem to see how then you combine them in a meaningful fashion. And there was a key paper that was produced by Hewitt and Manning a couple of years ago that introduced a very important idea, in my opinion, which is this idea of distances in these high-dimensional spaces. When you have an LLM, you can present a sentence, and for each word or each token in the sentence, you can think of the word as a coordinate in the space. And what Hewitt and Manning propose is that there exists a subspace where the words are placed in such a way that their distance tells you whether they are syntactically related or not. So for instance, in this case, a man on the moon smiled. Man would be sort of positioned close to smiled, whereas moon would be further away. And so that's a very simple binding principle. You bind through a particular geometrical principle, which is distance. Now, there is a missing piece to that first proposition, which we fulfill with Pablo Diego and Yair Lakretz in the lab, with this idea of the type of relation should also be represented. So for instance, if you have Anna likes Mary, this is not the same meaning as Mary likes Anna, and if you get it wrong, you can be in a potentially bad position depending on the social situation you're in. So you really want to know who is liking whom and who does what to whom. And so what we proposed with Pablo and colleagues is that the direction between the words is coding for this, the type of relationship. So for instance, you can think of, let's say, the horizontal direction over here would be coding for the object of, and the vertical direction in the schema would be coding for the subject of. And so then we can test this idea, this very simple geometrical principle of distances and direction coding for compositionality, coding for how things are bound together with labeled or specific types of relations. And we call this a polar coordinate system because you use distances and direction for your representations. Just have one more slide on the hypothesis part, and then I'll show you some 3D brains, which I'm sure you're all waiting for. The idea here is that you can input to your LLM much more complex sentences that have much more complex syntactic trees, like the cat lies on a big mat that is by the sofa. And what this polar coordinate system will allow you to do is to re-extract this sort of high-dimensional molecule that the LLM has built by positioning words in a specific way, such that the words that are close to one another in this high-dimensional space are linked to one another. And the relative direction that they have codes for how they relate to one another. So for instance, you'll see that the determinant of tends to follow a similar type of direction. This is true in particular in the middle layers of the large language models. Here is an example for GPT-2. And this is more and more true as the language models get better and get bigger. And these are, each dot here is different, a large language model that is publicly available on Hugging Face platforms. All right, so overall what we seem to observe is that as these LLM get better at processing language, they seem to systematically shape their representations in a way that follow this very simple geometric principle that bind tokens together through distances and label this type of relationship through a direction. All right. So that's sort of a hypothesis that when we can then use to try to see whether indeed the brain use this type of code to represent language. And I won't show you conclusive evidence that this particular code is used, but I will show you a lot of evidence suggesting that whatever the LLMs are doing is indeed perhaps the best model that we have so far of how language is represented in the brain. All right, so how do we approach this in practice? You can input the same type of sentences or speech sounds to an LLM to the one that participants heard in the scanner. And this is here work that was led by Juliette Millet and Charlotte Couchetou when they were PhD students in the team. And then you can try to do a comparison. You can try to evaluate whether the pattern of activations in your model is similar or has the same type of geometry or topology to the pattern of activations of the human brain in response to the same input. We call this an encoding model, and it comes down to just a linear regression. So if you look at a cherry-picked voxel. This is the type of data that we have. On the horizontal axis is time from the beginning of a story. So they are listening to podcasts and Le Petit Prince. You have quite a lot of subjects in this curated data sets in Mandarin-speaking participants, English-speaking participants, and French participants. And you can see that in this particular voxel, at the beginning of the story, it goes up and then goes down and so forth. And you can indeed find a virtual or linear readout of Wave2Vec2 that is not exactly the same, but tends to follow a similar response, meaning that in response to the same input, to the same text, it tends to represent information in the same way for that particular voxel. Now we can repeat this type of analysis for every individual voxels in the brain and observe overall where we have similar representations between this model and brain activity. And it tends to peak in the supratemporal lobe, which is well known to be associated with speech processing. But it's pretty much significant in all of the cortex, perhaps at the exception of the sensory motor areas. And we also have a drop here because of the MRI artifact. Now, on its own, this is not that interesting, in my opinion. What is perhaps much more intriguing is that we can repeat the same type of analysis for every individual layers of the deep net. And then we can color code for each voxel of the brain which layer is indeed most similar to this particular voxel. And what you end up is with this over-the-top 3D animation, which I'll use as a static form to pretend that this is much more serious. In the auditory cortex over here, we have a color which is bluish, meaning that the voxels over here, on average, tend to be most similar to the first layer of the transformer in this model. Whereas voxel in IFG over here or in anterotemporal lobe tend to be color-coded in red, meaning that their activations seem to be most similar to the deepest layers in the transformer. And in between, you have this remarkably monotonous gradient on average across the 400-plus participants. And that, to me, is very striking, right? Because Wave2Vec2 and all of these AI models are not developed for neuroscience purposes. They are developed for industrial purposes. You want to be able to do automatic subtitling, source separation, and these sort of things. And yet, it seems that by training these models without any supervision, I should add, they are, in this case, they don't even have the notion of a word. Training these models suffice them to learn a hierarchy of representations which is remarkably mapping onto the known hierarchy of speech processing in the brain. It even highlights hierarchy that we sort of suspected, but were not clearly evidenced, like, for instance, here starting from the larynx motor cortex and climbing up to a Broca area. This type of analysis here that was done in fMRI, which is not really well resolved in time, but it can be also done with temporally resolved neuroimaging, in this case, MEG. This is here work that was led by Joséphine Rogel in the team, together with Valentin Villard. We can time lock the MEG brain responses to story listening to every individual words at T0, and again do this linear mapping between brain activity and the model activations for each layer. And we observe that the first layers of the network tend to correlate with brain activity earlier than the last layers, suggesting that this order of computation is also similar between the brain and these LLMs. Both of these previous studies were in speech perception. We can also do language production. And this is work that was done together with Svetlana Pinay and led by Lucy Zhang in the team. So we had participant type sentences in the MEG scanner. They didn't have any visual feedback. And we can time lock their MEG brain responses at each word onset and try to evaluate whether these MEG signals tend to correlate with different types of representations. So the representations of an LLM, the representation of a word embedding, of a syllable embedding, or of the letter. And now the sequence of representation seems to be reversed. We first see that the context is present in the brain, then the word, then the syllable, then the letter, and then the person starts actually typing this particular word. The similarity between brain and LLMs is not anecdotal. We now systematically benchmark these models onto a very large databases. And overall, we have a clear tendency. The better these LLMs are, the larger they are, generally, but also the more they tend to correlate linearly with brain activity. Each dot over here is one LLM, and it's color-coded by the family of models. And that suggests that there is kind of a partial convergence phenomenon. These LLMs are nowhere near at least their architecture, their training principles is extremely different from how the brain operates. And yet they seem to ultimately learn representations which are remarkably similar to those of the brain. All right. These are what we call encoding analysis. Every time we do this linear regression from the model to the brain. And it's really good to do this type of analysis, but it's also difficult to judge how much content there is in these brain signals that we record. For this, we want to do decoding. And so we also try to apply the same recipe, but in the other way around, usually with deep nets as opposed to linear regressions. For instance, here, this is work with Alexandre Desfossés, where we learn a deep learning architecture with contrastive learning and learn to align the representations of the MEG signals to the representations of Wave2Vec2 to try to, at each time point, be able to decode which word is more likely to have been perceived. And on average, It's really bad for any sort of downstream product application, but it's extremely good for at least as compared to what we anticipated. So for instance, here is a sentence that these three participants heard in the scanner. Thank you for coming, Ed. And you can see that for the subject three, it gets all of the words correctly. The decoder, you can retrieve the right word perfectly. For subject two, it makes some mistakes, like what is indicated to be more likely than thank by the decoder, and in is indicated to be more likely than Ed. And for the first subject, it never gets it right. But if you pay close attention, you'll see that the true words tend to be visible. So it tends to be in the top 10, top 20 most likely words output by the decoder out of 700 plus vocabulary sets. So it's way, way above chance level. Now we can do the same type of decoding on semantics, and this is work which is being led by Stéphane Dascoli in the team. So try to really recover the meaning of words. And in some cases, it's really striking. So for instance, when the participants hear the word extraordinary, the most likely word is indeed to be decoded is indeed extraordinary. But the second guess would have been uncompromising. Third guess would have been exceptional. Fourth guess, absolute, exceedingly. So you can see that it tends to pick up something which is not phonological. It seems to be really related to this semantic feature. And we have many examples of such cases. Similarly, as we do decoding in the case of speech perception, we can do decoding in the language production domain. This was led by Jarrod Levy in the team. Again, same architecture as in the previous slides, but this time trained to decode what people type. There is an additional set of tricks on top. But overall, you can see that the decoding performances are, in a sense, bad as compared to what you would have on a keyboard, right? It's about 4 out of 5 letters which are accurately decoded, which means that if you want to type with this, it would be pretty frustrating. But nevertheless, it's much higher than what we anticipated. All right. So there are many outstanding questions, of course, that still remain, like on the exact neural circuitry of syntactic trees, whether these trees are unique to language, whether recursion is involved, and how. But I want to turn for the rest of the talk to a slightly different question, which is about the development of language. Because language, of course, is not purely innate, right? It's a capacity that we have predispositions for, but which is acquired through culture and exposition. And of course, it's extremely difficult to study the development of language because it's difficult to study the brain of little children. And I know some teams are extremely courageous and convince the kids and the infants to go in the scanner, and I think Ghislaine will speak about this tomorrow. But I'm not that courageous. I thought that was too hard. But I was kind of complaining to my friend and colleague Pierre Bourdillon about this technical issue of not being able to study the development of language, and he told me that actually they record on a daily basis the brain of young children in the epileptic units. And so we hired a great PhD student, Linnea Evanson, who is now a postdoc in the team, to basically apply the very same type of toolkits that I showed you, but this time on intracranial recordings of young children. So this is a clinical setup, right? These are kids who suffer from severe epileptic seizures, who require brain surgery to try to treat this pathology. And these are stereotactic EEG, so it's implanted with this sort of line array in the brain. And of course, the position of these electrodes are decided solely by the clinical team. And this allows the team to identify the most likely pathological tissues and the one that create the epileptic seizures and potentially that should be removed after a week of recording. The bottom line is that these patients stay for about a week in the clinical unit, a week during which Linnea could come up and ask them and their legal guardians whether they would be happy to participate in the research and just listen to natural stories. So she made an app on a phone. She left them the phone, and the children could decide to listen to, in this case, chapters of The Little Prince, whenever they felt like it. And then we can timestamp at every moment of time whether a word had occurred and try to analyze the brain response. We recorded 46 patients in this first study that covers pretty much all of the cortex, perhaps at the exception of the occipital lobe, where the epileptic seizures tend not to be coming from. And the patients are aged from 2-year-old to adulthood, and 2-year-old tends to be the age limit because the skull is not sufficiently rigid before that age, and so it prevents the surgeons from operating beforehand. Even though ideally you would like to operate as young as possible because the brain is more plastic early on and therefore could recover more easily from a lesion. All right, so for each of these electrodes, we can apply this linear mapping first to linguistic features. So we can try to see whether phonemes are represented in different parts of the brain. We observe things that have been extremely well established, in particular by Eddie Chang at UCSF, which is that the phonetic representations tend to be observable in the superior temporal lobe. And what we observe is that these representations don't seem to be different across age group. So the youngest patients from 2 to 5 year olds tended to have similar type of representations to the 6 and above year old patients. However, for word level representation, this starts to change. We see that it's associated with a more distributed network. The time courses of these representations is much slower. It's a span over 2 seconds. And now there is a developmental effect. So we have the older children that show a larger or better representation than the youngest one, which makes sense, right? As the kid grows, the representations of individual words and of the vocabulary improves. But now we have a new correlate of that. Now, what is also interesting is that we can do the exact same analysis, but this time with language models, because these language models are not just descriptive. We can train them and see how this training influences the mapping with the brain. And this is what we see here. We see that as the patients get older, or at least the older patients, show similarity with language models that is higher than the younger patients. And we also see that training the LLM makes them more similar to the older patient than to the younger patients. So it starts to suggest that there is some sort of shared developmental trajectory in between the language model and the human brain. Now, there are, of course, many limitations onto this type of studies. These are epileptic patients with often abnormal developmental trajectories. These are French patients only. Many of the things that we use in the LLMs are implausible in terms of learning rules, architectures, and so forth. But still, it's very interesting, I think, because for the first time, we have a model that can learn to process language and can be directly compared to the developmental trajectory of the human brain and how it processes language across these important years. Another thing that makes me very optimistic about this line of research is that we can actually apply it outside of the task that we set for the participants. So the participants, as I mentioned, were listening to The Little Prince on a phone whenever they felt like it. And that was the analysis was solely based on this sort of 1-hour-ish type of recording. But in fact, we can do the same type of mapping between the brain activity and the ambient sound, which is being recorded in the clinical units, and train over hundreds of hours this mapping system. And we observe that it improved the decoding performances. So there is a way to get better and better and more precise prediction on how the brain should react to sound in general and to speech in particular. All right. How am I doing with time?
Maybe 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay. All right. So this idea of a syntactic tree based on a polar coordinate system is a simple principle for representing language in vectoral systems and in LLMs in particular. But we don't think that this is specific necessarily to language. This is a much more general problem that was actually touched upon this morning, which is the problem of binding. In many situations, you want to understand how these different objects need to be linked in, or how they link in the representational space. This is true for mathematical inequalities. This is true for visual scenes where you want to know whether an object is above another one or by the side of another one. It's true for social structures. It's true for much more complex topologies as well. So what we did with Pablo is to try to see whether we could recover these compositional structure from LLMs and just telling them what the scene was about and verifying indeed whether the representation of the underlying structure was coded in this way. And it seems to be always the case for all of these very different types of semantic exemplars. It's particularly the case in the middle layers, and it's you need to have these LLM be trained for them to represent the information in this way. So ideally, you would like to really push for these ideas way beyond language and syntax. And this is also why we try in the team to apply the very same type of methods, not just to speech and language, but to a variety of other domains. For instance, in the case of vision, you can also do a linear mapping between an unsupervised model and the brain activity in response to images and observe a similar type of alignment. And it's because that it is because we have this alignment that we can decode what people see from these fMRI brain signals with a remarkable precision. And where this goes, in my opinion, is towards something which I think is quite changing how we may approach system neuroscience in the future, which is an integration of these different fields into one standard model of the brain. All of these AI systems are becoming more and more integrated, and all of these systems are, for now, the best model that we have of how the brain works in many ways. So for instance, and this was led by Stéphane Dascoli, we trained a multimodal AI system to try to best predict brain activity given a variety of input, video input, text, speech, or sound input. And this was in the context of a competition, so the goal was really set with a held out test set where the participants were recorded with fMRI over 80 hours each, so that was quite intense for them, while they were watching movies. All of the models that were publicly released use a similar type of method. They use pre-trained models, pre-trained AI models, and then try to use those representation as, let's say, a bedrock for predicting brain activations. What's remarkable is that you can then test how these models work and how they operate in different conditions. And I will just finish with this. This is an example of an out-of-domain evaluation where the video that people watched was not a naturalistic movie. It was kind of a cartoonish video. But you'll see that it captures the prediction of the model are remarkably similar or aligned to what we know in neuroscience. All right, so we have some sound. There is a bit of a delay in between the board response. All right, I'll stop here. When you have a lot of noise, you see that you have activation in the expected areas, in the auditory cortex and around. When you start to have words that are flashing up onto the screen, you have an activation here in the visual waveform area, well known by Laurent Cohen and Stan. That was also mentioned this morning. When the video becomes a little bit over the top, you have like a really strong recruitment, so it seems, of the visual system.
Hello, Emily.
Hi.
One day, when you are old enough, you will be impregnated with a perfect clone of yourself. You will later...
And when you have text, or when you have speech, you have the speech networks which activates. And these are just model prediction, which means that we have now the ability to train at scale on naturalistic stimuli and to then use those very complex models to try to probe how the brain activity would have reacted in this case, and perhaps use those as again, hypothesis generators and try to investigate what we actually don't really understand or what kind of data we should try to collect in order to improve this type of modeling. All right, so the goal here is really not to try to tell you that AI systems are identical to how the brain works, but really to try to convince you that they are extremely powerful tools for modeling cognition in the brain. And the road is still long. These large language models, in spite of their names, are still very small as compared to the brain in terms of synapses. It's four orders of magnitude smaller than the brain in terms of what they can learn. They're still extremely inefficient in the energy that they consume and, of course, in the data that they use. We are exposed to about 10,000, 13,000 words a day. So we learn language in less than 10 million words. And these algorithms require trillions of words for their training. And so what this means is that the exact architecture and the learning principles that allow a species to learn language remains to be discovered. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jérémy.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.